Good afternoon. So last time we talked about vector instructions or single instruction multiple data, this idea that our processors are going to provide us with instructions which perform multiple operations on a little array of values at a time, and that we could use this to take advantage of, well, extra ALU pieces that they have. So they have these ALUs which are do multiple things at once, taking multiple values in parallel, and that this is a way that processors can add more computational capacity without adding lots of extra instruction, you know, conflict checking for data dependencies and so on. Talked about profilers, that if you actually want to optimize and you have a program where we're not just telling you this function, make it faster, you want to figure out, well, what parts of my program matter? Is this thing that I think I want to optimize actually slow? And a profiler is a way of finding out, well, yep, it's taking up most of your time, or nope, it's not going to help you to make that thing faster because it's only taking up 1% of your time. Then we moved on from optimization to talking about, well, we have multiple processes on our machine, and how do we actually make them seem to have this illusion that, well, I'm just running my instructions, yet other things end up running on the machine. This idea that we're sharing a single core with multiple machines by splicing that core up in time, that we run a program for some amount of time, and then even though the program doesn't have any instructions to make anything special happen, we end up switching to another program. And this is known as a context switch, that we save what we call the context, the state of the program, into some space that in the OS, and the OS ends up running the other program. And we had a mechanism for actually starting the OS to do this process, since we couldn't rely on an instruction running the OS, of an exception, that the processor would, because of something, we'll talk about the possible somethings later today, will decide to start running the OS, and the OS can decide to do things like switch to another program. And along with switching to another program, we talk about how different programs have different address spaces, that if I have a particular address in one program, that I can use the same number as my address in another program, but it actually refers to some different part of memory. And the way that works is each program has its own address space, and that's implemented with this notion of address translation, that the OS sets this mapping where we use certain addresses in our program, and those end up being different addresses on the real machine, and the processor, you know, looks at the mapping the OS supplied and applies that every time the program tries to access memory in any way. So any questions on what we talked about last time? Okay, so I believe when we left off last time, we were at this notion of that mention we had memory protection, so two addresses and the same address in one program, you know, would be independent, that either if you try to access the same address, it will either crash, or, well, it will work, but it's not the same value in memory, it won't change what the other program does. They're isolated in memory, even though they have the same layout, program A's writable data is not the same as program B's, even if they happen to have the same addresses in the assembly. That they're different programs, and the way this worked is we had this special mapping that the OS set, and that could make sure that the same address ends up in different places for each of the programs. And one thing about this mapping is that you notice on this picture I have all these holes, these places where there's no valid addresses. Well, we have part of this mapping which is set by the OS not to point to an actual location in memory, but just to point to, hey, not, there's nothing there, trigger an error instead of making the memory access do anything. And this overall mechanism, you know, we're going to implement with this with something called virtual memory, which we'll talk about probably at the end of the day, and also a lot in the last weeks of class. And the mapping is something called page tables, which you hopefully read about a little bit. And the mapping is part of what's changed in the context switch. So in addition to changing the registers and the condition codes and the program counter, when we switch between programs, we're also going to change the address space, which is means that we're going to switch from one mapping to another. And this is part of what the OSS job is on a context switch, is it needs to save the old mapping somewhere and restore the new one. So any questions on this here? Okay, so when we put this together, we have this idea that our programs will execute whatever instructions they want, and occasionally something under them, you know, takes over the CPU, but then we switch back to them. And to that program, it looks like we're just executing a sequence of instructions, and sometimes we don't have the CPU all the time, but it looks like we just have this continuous sequence of instructions that keeps running all the time. That is known as a thread, that idea that looks like we have our own CPU, even though really we're sharing the CPU with other programs. But the only way we can tell that is by looking at things like timings, which aren't really part of our instructions. And we also have this address space, and that gives us the illusion that we have our own memory. Because as far as we're concerned, any memory address I want, it's mine, it's not interfering with any other program, and I can't notice what any other program is doing with memory. It's as if my memory is all mine. And for the CPU, like, I can change all my registers, it's as if the CPU is all mine. You know, I can do jumps, and it doesn't matter what other programs are doing with the condition codes. It's as if I have my own CPU. And together, we call the notion of having both of these a process. So this is what we think of when we're running a program. The OS is giving us a process. It's as if the program has its sort of own mini machine, because we think the big components of a computer are the CPU and its memory, the most important ones. So each program acts as if it has its own machine, even though in reality we're sharing both the actual CPU cores and the actual memory between multiple programs. So any questions on this idea of a process? Okay. So one minor point, I have thread with a S. So, you know, most simply, we have the program has one core that it thinks it has. We can also have programs which think they have multiple cores, and that's more than one thread. And you'll learn about that when you take OS more, but that's why there's parentheses S, we can have multi-threaded programs. If you want to take advantage of having multiple physical cores, that's what you generally need to do. Though you could have multiple threads without having multiple physical cores, they'll be switched in time by the OS the same way we would be switched in time if we had different processes with different memory address spaces. Okay, so as a mechanism to implement threading, we talked about interrupting the program with this exception. And that exception was this sort of mysterious thing where the program was doing nothing special. We were just executing jump instructions in our loop, and the only problem is we took longer than the OS wanted. And there are different kinds of exceptions. So there are exceptions which we'll call synchronous, which are triggered by a particular instruction. And that was obviously not one of those. We didn't see any instruction in there which is doing anything weird. So that was an asynchronous exception. It came from outside the program. But we also have these synchronous exceptions, which are going to be triggered by events in the program. And as a preview, probably the most notable one is if we access memory we're not supposed to, that's going to trigger a synchronous exception known as a fault. And maybe the OS is going to say, I don't know how to handle that, and crash your program and print out some cryptic message like segmentation fault. So that's an example of a synchronous exception where there's a particular instruction which did something which was responsible for it that we were actually running. But we also have these asynchronous instructions exceptions, which are that something that the program wasn't doing triggered the event. And our textbook divides these further into these four categories. And these are our textbook's names. I'm not going to promise that you'll see all these names later. I'll talk about that more later. So our textbook divides these into interrupts. And that's our textbook's name for everything that's externally triggered. And we've seen one kind of interrupt, which is how do we stop our loop from running? And this is typically with a timer interrupt. So the way the timer interrupt works is that the CPU has this conceptually external timer device. So it's as if it's like connected to the CPU remotely, even though it's probably on the same hardware, but it's connected the same way like a keyboard would be connected. And the OS can configure this timer, and after some fixed interval, it's going to send a signal to the CPU, and that signal is going to cause the CPU to trigger this exception process and start running the OS. And so the OS sets this up before it runs a program that's worried might just use all the CPU forever. And that way, the OS gets ensured that eventually it will get a chance to run and say, whoa there, I want someone else to use the CPU now, even though that program doesn't actually contain any instructions. It's going to be this timer that's going to cause that to happen. So questions on this timer interrupt idea? So another kind of interrupt we have are for I/O devices. So if I have a key press, the OS wants to do something about that. It might want to change what program is running because I pressed a key, and so on. And the OS is typically not on the CPU, so it doesn't get a chance to check that. So we have this externally triggered interrupt where the processor will say, okay, the keyboard is telling me something's ready. I'm going to run the OS and have the OS figure out, well, what do I want to do about that? And the OS gets to run and it makes its decision. Do I want to start running another program right away? Or do I want to just record the key press and keep going back to what I was doing? Whatever the OS decides, it needs to run to do that. And this is the mechanism by which the processor makes it run, even if it were in the middle of our infinite loop. So on. So we also have these synchronous exceptions. And there's one kind we haven't talked about yet, which our textbook calls traps. And these are intentionally triggered. So these are things where there's something in the program whose only purpose is to cause an exception to happen. And the kind of these we care about are what are known as system calls. And this is where I have a program and I want to ask the OS to do something. Now, you might say, well, couldn't we just use a function call? Well, why do we need to trigger this exception mechanism when we're writing an instruction anyways? Can't we just call a function? We'll have a reason related to something called kernel mode, which we'll see later, why we need to run this exception-making instruction rather than a normal function call. But we're going to use this mechanism to start the OS running, but it's going to be that there's going to be some instruction we're running whose only purpose is triggering exceptions. There's nothing else it can do. And these are things you use all the time because your programs often need the OS to do something for them. So for example, let's say I have a program which prompts for some input. And then I haven't typed anything yet. So we need to wait for me to type something in order to actually get that input. So my program is going to make a system call saying to the OS, hey, I'd like to get some keyboard input. Tell me when it's ready and give it to me. And the OS is going to say, well, don't have any keyboard input for you now. So I'm just going to remember that. But I'm going to run someone else because I don't want to just leave the CPU idle. So I'm going to run someone else for a while. And eventually, at some point later, while we're running another program, the keyboard actually sends a signal to the processor. The processor starts running the OS. And the OS says, oh, the keyboard has something for me. Let me look up what I was supposed to do about that. And I say, oh, read input wanted me to tell it when there was input. So I'll do that right now. And that's what the OS decided. So we have the combination of these two exceptions involved in reading that single input from the keyboard. First, to register with the OS, hey, I want some input, and also let the OS do other things while we're waiting. And second, to actually handle the keyboard giving us input and the OS deciding to switch to the program which wanted the input. So any questions on this process? Yeah?
Did you ever have two programs waiting for input? And if so, what would happen?
So the question is, could two programs be waiting for input? Absolutely. And the OS needs to decide how it's going to resolve that situation. So remember that in all these sort of blurry lines here, this is code in the OS running. So the OS can have a list of the programs waiting for input, and it can use whatever mechanism it likes to decide what to do with that. So if the OS wants to just make the first one get the first input and the second one get the second, it can do that. If it wants to mirror it to both of them, it can do that. It's all just code where it has to decide what makes sense for a keyboard. Yeah?
So would it track and trigger by scanf or cn?
So the question is, would something like scanf or cn trigger a trap? Yes. As long as they need to get input from the keyboard, they have to trigger a trap at least sometimes. Yes?
So while you're waiting for green color and pink color operations are running while you're waiting for input.
Yeah, so the question is, this green and pink represent other things running while we're waiting for input? Yes. So the idea is that the OS switches to other programs while we're waiting for input rather than just leaving the CPU not being able to do anything, as long as there are other programs that want to run. Yeah.
So if you're doing CN or scanf, but you use a pipe to get that input,
so the question is, I know about pipes where I get input from other programs as my normal input. Does it still need to use a system call? And the answer is, so does it still need to use a system call or does it still need to wait? I'll do both. So does it still need to use a system call? Well, the data you want to read is not in your address space. So you need to use a system call because you can't access the data that was written because it's not in your memory. So you need to use the system call for that reason, even if you don't have to wait. As for whether you wait, well, if the other program hasn't written yet, we're going to have to wait for it to write, and we'll have a similar procedure, but rather than waiting for an interrupt to happen, we're going to wait for the other program to do its trap to write. And that has to be a trap because the OS needs to know that it's writing in order to start you from the read. Yeah, your question.
So between the green and the pink, would it be something like a timer?
So the question is, what's happening between the green and the pink? It could be something like a timer. It could be another trap to read from a different thing. Lots of things. Yeah.
Let's say you have a program and it needs to be very low latency and has to respond as soon as something happens on the keyboard. Is there a way that the program could tell the operating system not to schedule something in between?
So the question is, let's say I want the program to respond immediately when it gets keyboard input. Could I have the OS not run something in between? So the answer is yes, but that's not actually really what determines how long you wait for the most part. Because the idea here is when the key press happens, the amount of time we have to wait is how long this takes. So there's a question of what can slow that down. And with this picture, it doesn't seem like that's actually the other programs running are actually a problem. Now, in the real world, we have some complicating factors. So one of them is not that that takes a lot of time, but that you have corrupted our cache with all the stuff from the pink program, so you might run a little slower than you expect. And another problem is, let's say we have multiple input devices, the OS has to handle them one at a time, and that would be a problem. But that's not something we're going to fix by not running the pink and the green program. We have to have some other way of fixing that, which is outside the scope of this course. Other questions? Okay, so those are traps briefly, and we'll go into more detail about what system calls look like later, as far as what the code to actually run them looks like, and how do we tell the OS what operation we want to do. So another type of exception are these faults. And we've talked about segmentation fault, which, the thing that when the OS gets it, it reflects it back to you as the segmentation fault message. which is usually memory not in the address space. Turns out some other things end up there. And we have a bunch of other types. Okay, so now that we know about the types of exceptions, I'll talk about aborts briefly later, because they're the least important kind as far as we're concerned. So let's talk about, we know what exceptions need to do. What's the implementation look like? So the processor is going to detect the condition of the exception. So either we have a program error or a program, you know, error slash deliberate trigger or an external event. So we have the either deliberate, I want to get the OS to do something for me, or the not deliberate, I accessed memory I wasn't supposed to or did something like divided by zero, or an external event. So we detect on a condition that needs an exception to happen. Then we're going to save the current value of the PC somewhere. And then we're going to jump to the exception handler. And this is the jump done without a program instruction to do so. So we needed to save the PC so we can go back. And the idea is that when we go back, you know, we want to, for a trap, we want to go back to next instruction. So because when we return from the trap, we want to be go to the thing after that deliberate triggering of an exception. And for something like for an interrupt, we want to keep running, you know, running wherever we left off. Off. And for a fault, we want to go back to the failing instruction in case we can repair it, which we'll talk about when we talk about virtual memory, how that could possibly be. But for right now, all we know how to do for these failing instructions is probably crash the program, in which case it doesn't matter what we save. Yes?
So based on the types of exception, we either like always save current value of PC, right?
So we're always, so based on the type of exception, we're saving the current value of PC or the next, it depends whether it's the current the instruction that triggered it or the next instruction or whatever, but it's around, it's where we want to go back to is the important thing. Yeah. Yeah. This is to go back after handling. So assuming we want to keep running the program, where do we want to go back to? And so for an interrupt, we want to go back such that the program won't notice anything happened. For a trap, for like a system call, we don't want to do a system call again, we want to go back afterwards. It's always so the program won't notice anything happened. And for faults, we'll talk about making it so we can retry the failing operation if we somehow fix something. We'll talk when we talk about virtual memory about how we could possibly do that. But for now, it seems like for faults, it doesn't really matter because we're just going to crash the program. But we need the OS to do that because we can't just keep running instructions in the program. So we save the current value of the PC so we can go back to the program. So we save whatever value is most useful to go back to in the processor and then go to the OS. Does this make sense? So I'm going to talk about exception implementation. And I'm going to talk about a simplified version because the real version is a little more complicated in ways that aren't particularly interesting. So in the simplified version, we have a register, which we call the exception table base register. And this points to an exception table. And what the exception table contains is the location of the OS code that should be run when an exception happens. So the idea is we have an entry for each kind of exception. So divide by zero has an entry, timer interrupts have an entry, and everything in between, as you know, different type of exception has its own entry in this table. And the OS makes handlers for each type that do whatever it wants to do. And so what the hardware is doing is it's saving that old program counter. It's looking up in that table to figure out where to jump to. and so on, then the OS gets to take control, and the OS can do whatever it needs to do. So, for example, for a context switch, the OS needs to save all the other registers too, so it's going to do that. If it's going to just crash the program, maybe it doesn't care about saving all those other registers. And it's just going to discard them, report an error, and run something else. Yes?
Does the exception table ever change, or why do you need to store the base address in a register?
So the question is, why do we have the exception table? Does the exception table ever change? So why don't we just have it at a fixed address? So some processors do that. Some processors just say, this memory address is where the exception table is. Usually it's preferred to have a register for it just so the OS has some flexibility as to how it lays out its memory. But it indeed is a valid choice to just say it's at a fixed address. But that's typically not what processors do, just to make it more easier for OSs to decide where things are in memory. Yes? So where's the number come on the index of the table? The processor just has some static assignment that exception type 0 is divided by 0 and so on. So just they make some choices about which number is which. And sometimes this is somewhat configurable by the OS, but generally it's mostly the processor has decided which is which. So other questions? Okay, and so what we need to handle exceptions in our CPU, so we need some instruction to set that exception table base location. We need some instruction to jump based, we need some logic to when an exception happens to look things up in that exception table and figure out the address to jump to. We need the logic to save the old PC, the place we want to go back to, and maybe some more stuff. And we need to have somewhere to save it, so we might have a special register to save it to, or we might save it to a particular memory location that's, you know, by convention or that the OS specifies somehow. And we also want a new instruction to return from an exception, to go back to that saved PC. I'll talk about a reason why we don't want to do that with this return when we talk about kernel mode. Yes?
When you jump to the place in the exception table and you're handling the exception, are you in the same context as you were when you triggered the exception?
So the question is, when you jump to, when you're starting running the exception handler, are you in the same context? So in a context is not as well defined as I'd like for this question. Generally, with what I'm telling you, that the CPU has saved just the bare minimum amount, and if the OS wants to remember anything about like register values, like we haven't changed them, so it needs to save them. So in practice, there's some variation in how much processors save. So sometimes they save the PC plus like the stack pointer, or sometimes they save the PC plus all the registers. But you know, the minimum you need to do is you need to save the PC because there's no way the OS could figure out what that is if you don't save it. But everything else the OS could figure out, could save, because it's not, if it's, as long as you don't change it.
So then when you return to the old PC, you still have all of the virtual address space that you had before you triggered the exception?
So the question is, are we in the same address space?
Yeah.
So yes. So there's no, I never talked about switching address spaces, so we have not done that. So it's all the same address space that we're going to be in. If the OS wants to switch address spaces, it needs to do that itself with a separate instruction. So other questions? So our exception handler, so as I mentioned, the structure generally is that it's going to save the process's state somewhere, usually. So it saves the context. The processor has saved part of the context, at least the PC, sometimes the PC and the stack pointer. But we need to save everything else we care about saving. And we do whatever we want to do based on the exception. So if it's like a keyboard interrupt, we handle it and figure out what to do. and we restore some process's state. So either we're going back to the same program, so we just decide, okay, yeah, I don't want to run another program, or we change to a different program. But regardless, it's the same process. We just have a context, we restore it, and we return from the exception to jump back to the program. So questions about this general procedure? So this means that what's actually happening in our loop case is that a timer interrupt happens, and the exception table lookup happened, and this decided to switch to the SSH program by changing address spaces and registers and then returning from the exception, writing in this different program because all those things change. Okay, so questions? Okay, so I talked about sort of this mechanism for exceptions. We have these exception handlers and this exception table base. So one thing you might say is, well, given what I've described, you know, I have my infinite loop where I couldn't actually take over the department machine and not let you use it because there were these timer interrupts. So maybe I can fix that problem and just set up my own exception table where I have a much better timer interrupt handler. Just returns immediately, it's way faster. Also keeps my program running because we aren't switching to a program there. And you might say, okay, so why can't I do this? Well, let's try. So here's what this would look like on x86. In x86, the actual set the exception handler table instructions called LIDT for load interrupt descriptor table. And I can write that in assembly. I can run it in my program. And if I try to run this program, I get segmentation fault is the message that gets printed out. So that instruction, instead of actually setting the exception table, triggered a fault, and my OS decided to report that back to me with the message segmentation fault. And the reason for this is that this is what's known as a privileged instruction. It's an instruction that only the OS is allowed to do. I, as a normal program, am not allowed to try to set the exception table to my own exception table in order to handle timer interrupts myself. Only the OS gets to do that. If I want it done differently, I need to make the OS do it for me. I can't do it myself. So this means that we can share machines between users safely because of this, because I can't decide, no, really, I want all the CPU. I'm going to make that happen. And there's other instructions which work this way. So for example, setting the address space of a program is a privileged instruction. I can't do it. I have to have the OS do it for me. This means I can't access other people's memory by changing my address space to include their actual memory, changing that mapping. Talking to I/O devices is a privileged instruction. So I can't decide to read other people's files because I can't talk to the hard drive. I need the OS to do that for me. And the idea is the OS has code which decides when it's okay to do stuff. When is it okay for a timer interrupt to keep running the same program? When is it okay to read something from the disk? And because I have to go through the OS's code, the OS gets to decide what am I allowed to do. And to implement this, the processor has two modes. It has a kernel mode, where privileged instructions work, and a user mode, where privileged instructions cause an exception instead of working. So, questions? Yeah?
So the kernel mode is the program running by OS, and the user mode is code run by code written by the user?
So in normal operation, only OS code should ever be run in kernel mode, and all user code will be run in user mode. So kernel mode interacts with exceptions. So one thing exceptions do is that when an exception occurs and we start running the exception handler, another thing the processor does is switch to kernel mode. And I mentioned I'd give you a reason we needed this return from exception instruction. So in addition to setting the program counter like a return or a jump, that instruction is going to leave kernel mode and switch back to user mode. So in this way, when we ask the OS to do something with our system call, that's why we can't use a normal call, because we want to switch to kernel mode, and the way we do that is by causing an exception to happen. That's why we want to trigger a deception deliberately, because that's how we enter this kernel mode, where we can do things like talk to IO devices, or change address spaces, or change the exception table. And switching back to our normal program ends up switching back to user mode, so we don't have to worry that when we switch back, the program can do things that it's not supposed to do. If it wants to do that, it still needs to make a system call. Okay, so questions on this? So something you may have noticed if you're paying very careful attention here is that I said the exception table is this thing in memory. And the OS gets to modify it when we have a system call. And you might be wondering, well, why can't I just modify the OS's memory? Why can't I just change the OS's memory to change that exception table directly if it's in there in my address space? Or why can't I modify where it points to? So the exception table points to some code here. Why can't I just edit that code for the OS? You know, and I decided I couldn't change the exception table to change the timer interrupt handler. Why can't I just write to those instructions and fix them to make the first instruction return from exception? Yeah?
User versus
privileges. Yeah, so this should be something where the user shouldn't be able to write to that memory. But as I mentioned, we don't switch address spaces when we grab an exception handler. So there needs to be an extra mechanism to support this. And typically, what modern OSs do is we reserve part of the address space for the OS. So there's this big region at the top, which I have marked sort of half grayed out as used by the OS. And when we set that mapping, we can set part of that mapping to be kernel mode only. So the mapping, in addition to specifying where program addresses go versus, you know, to real addresses, to what we'll call physical addresses later on, we have this idea that parts of this mapping can work, but if you try to use them outside of kernel mode, they won't work. And this is how the OS can have its exception handler code not be modified by the user program. It can have its exception table be accessible in memory without switching address spaces all the time, without changing that mapping whenever it wants to do something, and still not be accessible by the user program. And the kernel mode only part, if you try to access it in user mode, it triggers a fault. Just like unmapped, just like holes in that memory. So questions on this idea? So the combination of this means that we have two things which cause what we call protection fault, so-called protection fault, because the OS is being protected from the programs by this fault. So one is the program tries to access memory it doesn't own, and that can include addresses which aren't mapped, or addresses which are set as kernel only, or the program tries to do other things that, you know, are special instructions, accessing IO devices, changing the exception table base register, and so on. And the OS gets control, and right now, the big thing we know about the OS doing is crashing the program. But we still need to run the OS to do that, because the processor, all it knows how to do is execute more instructions from the program. It needs to talk to the OS, what do you actually want me to do if I can't run this program? Because only the OS knows how to do that. So questions on this idea? So I mentioned earlier we'd go into more detail about what system calls look like. So now we know why we need system calls, because the program can't just do things that require these privileged operations. And that includes a lot of things we want to do in our program. So we talked about reading input as one thing which needed it. We also need it for reading and writing to files, for because we can't communicate with the hard drive directly. We need it for allocating memory, because we want to change our address space to have more parts of it have a mapping. And that's all things that only the OS can do. And there's a bunch more you could probably think of. And we need to use this system call, this trigger and exception mechanism, because we need to run code in kernel mode for this to happen. There's nothing we could possibly do. We're not just asking the OS for convenience reason. We're asking it because it's the only way we can possibly do this operation. So I mentioned that we have this deliberate exception triggering thing. In 64-bit x86, there's an instruction called syscall. And all it does is trigger an exception. And that exception has a particular number in the particular place in the exception table, so there's a handler for this. And everything about how that system call request services is defined by the OS. So the OS, this is just the mechanism the OS gets to run, but the OS gets to decide, in that system call handler, what am I going to do? So like we do for the call instruction, we have to make a convention about how am I going to figure out what my caller is asking me to do. And we're going to do the same thing for this system call handler. So we'll know a system call happened, we figure out what is the program asking me to do. And Linux's convention is that it looks at the registers, and it's decided that RAX is going to contain a system call number. So there's lots of things I might want to do. I might want to allocate memory, I might want to read from my input, I might want to write to my output, I might want to start a new program. All these things are going to have different system call numbers, and that's going to determine which operation I do. And some of these operations have arguments, like if I want to write output, I need to specify where am I writing it to, what's the output, how big is it. Those are going to go in the registers RDI, RSI, RDX, and so on. And because the system call handler sees all the registers of the user program, it can easily read these arguments and the system call number and decide what to do. And the Linux convention is, after the system call, we're going to return from the exception, and the PC that's saved when the system call happens is the one immediately after the syscall instruction. So we're going to start running immediately there. And the OS is going to change RAX to the return value of the system call. And Linux has this convention that if the system call triggered an error, it's going to set a negative number for that return value, otherwise it's going to be positive. So this is almost the same as a normal function call. The big difference is rather than specifying the address of a function to call and having it in the call instruction, we set RAX beforehand to specify what operation we want to do. We have no idea where the code for that is, but we don't care. We just specify the number of our operation and then run this syscall instruction. So questions, this convention. Now, as I said, this is a convention, so other OSs might choose a different way of doing this. So here's an example of a program that directly uses system calls on Linux. So first thing you might notice is this isn't main. So it turns out that the actual entry point for programs on Linux is this function called underscore start by default. And the idea of that is that usually, when you compile a normal C program, there's this bit of assembly code supplied by the compiler, which calls your main function. And as part of calling it, one of the things it does is it makes sure it calls a system call after it returns to exit your program. Because otherwise, you're just going to keep running instructions. where you have to return to somewhere, so it sets that up. But here, we're not using that because I'm not writing C code. I'm not ever returning from this. So here I have two system calls. So on Linux, I'm going to first write hello world, and the way I'm going to do that is I'm going to specify the system call number for write, which happens to be, when I look it up in the kernel source code, 1. I need to specify where I'm writing to, which I specify with a file descriptor number. Happens that 1 represents standard output. I have to specify the string I'm writing and the size of that string as an argument. And then once I've set all those registers up, I make the syscall. And if I wanted to, I could, you know, check RAX for errors here, if I wanted to do that, to see if the write worked or not. Then after that, I make another system call. So I set the ARC registers again. I ask for system call number 60, which happens to be exit. Because if I just return from this, there's nothing to return to. So I have to ask the OS, hey, stop running me. And that's what the exit system call does. And I pass an argument to this, so this is equivalent to exit 0. Question? So. Yeah.
So does the second syscall exit you from the first syscall? Is that basically what's happening?
So the question is, does the second syscall exit you from the first syscall? No. So this first syscall happens, and then execution continues right here. So after the first syscall, we start running this move queue instruction when we return from that exception. Yes. So putting 60 into RAX tells the OS when in a system call handler, Linux looks at that and says, oh, you want me to exit, so I'm going to get rid of your process for you. Because we can't deallocate our process ourselves. That involves changing lots of things that are managed by the OS. So we have to ask the OS to do it for us. Yes?
So if the first system call detects an error, does the system call forward to work?
So the question is, what happens if the first system call detects an error? So on Linux, the convention is that any sort of error with the system call, all that it does is it doesn't return 0 in RAX. In this program, we aren't checking that, so we won't know. But that's the convention on Linux, and that includes for things like, what if I passed an address which wasn't valid to write? It turns out it just returns not 0. Yeah.
So why haven't we had to do the exit system call and all the assembly that we need?
So why haven't you had to do that? Because you've written main typically, or another function, and there's some code written by the compiler which basically does exit main, written by the compiler, which handles that for you. So when main is run, it's set up to return to something which will do this exit system call. So other questions? Okay. So this is our system call, and the system call handler in the kernel is going to do something like save all the registers, look up RAX, and have a table of the actual functions for each kind of system call, run it. Then it's going to restore all the registers and return from the exception starting at the next instruction in the program, assuming everything went normally. And we have system calls for all the sorts of things you might want to do. So allocating memory, creating new processes, running new programs, terminating, accessing files, and so on. So you may have used functions which are called system calls, but you've called normal functions and they do a system call. And these are typically what are called system call wrappers. So commonly in libraries, you'll have these functions which all they do is they set a system call number and do a syscall. And the idea here is that from C code, you can't actually run the syscall instruction directly. You can't actually set RAX directly. So this is a minimal assembly wrapper to switch between the way the kernel expects you to set up system calls and the way C expects you to set up function calls. So now we can call this open function, and it does exactly one system call with exactly the arguments we specify. And Linux has lots of these functions in its standard library where all they do is call a system call. So open is one example. The open function opens a file. And typically these functions, all they do is set a system call number. The arguments are already in the right registers. So here we have, for example, RDI equals the file name. It's already there. We don't do anything to change it. And that's what's going to be passed to the system call. And afterwards, these typically do a bit of work to interpret the return value and set this special ErrorNo value. This is the convention Linux uses for how it reports errors to C code, even though that's not how the kernel works, as far as what the system call does internally. And then from normal code, you can use this like so. You get a file descriptor returned, which is how we refer to the file in other system calls. And it looks just like normal functions. So questions on this? So those are system call wrappers, and that's typically what you'll use from C code. You won't actually write a syscall instruction directly, even if you're trying to do something that a particular syscall does at a very low level. You'll typically use one of these wrappers because, you know, there's no point in actually doing any more than what that wrapper does yourself, doing what that wrapper does yourself. Okay, so questions? Yeah. Why is it called a wrapper? Because it's doing the minimum work to make the syscall instruction look like a function call. And it's making the system call look like a function. But it doesn't actually contain an implementation of the system call. It's just wrapping the stuff you have to do to make the system call work. And otherwise, like, that's the name that everyone uses. I'm trying to make sure you'll recognize it when you see it somewhere. Other questions? Okay, so talked about exceptions, system calls, and so on. So I have some notes on terminology for everything I talked about. So an unfortunate thing about exceptions is that real-world terminology for exceptions is horribly inconsistent. So our textbook uses these terms with perfect confidence that interrupts mean external events, that exceptions mean any kind of thing which causes the OS to run, you know, via this exception table type mechanism, that traps mean anything that where the program deliberately triggers something. These are not going to be what happens. So you'll see lots of other terms in the real world. So for example, the x86 manuals call all kinds of exceptions interrupts sometimes. You might see some manuals use the term exception, but they only mean faults. They don't mean other types of exceptions as far as our book is concerned. You might see the term hard fault for what an abort is. I'll talk about that in a second. Said the least important kind. You might see the term trap, meaning what we call a fault. So he will talk about except protection traps, where they really mean what we call a fault. So I'm going to use the textbook's terms on things like exams, quizzes, and generally, but if you're reading processor manuals, you have to check. They use the terms in all sorts of ways. There's no standardization. I'm sorry. It's how things work. Also, I use the term kernel mode. There are some additional terms you might see which mean the same thing. like supervisor mode, privileged mode, ring zero. These all mean the same thing. Also, some systems have multiple levels of privilege. So we had user mode and kernel mode. Some systems have like three of them or four of them, where the highest one, there's one which is the most privileged and one which is the least privileged, and there's something in between where some privileged operations work, but not all of them. I guess I forgot to go over aborts, so let's talk about aborts for like a second. So aborts. Our textbook talks about these fourth category of aborts. These are, if something is wrong with the hardware, the processor wants to form the OS. So one example is some systems can detect that memory has gone bad. And we want to inform the OS about that, and we'll do that with an exception. And that exception is what our textbook calls an abort. And in the case of that, there's usually not much the OS can do besides try to save its state and give up because the machine's broken. Maybe there's something more in some cases, but that's what our textbook means by an abort. It's the system is broken, here OS, I'm letting you know, you can decide what you're doing about it. Assuming enough things work that you can do something. Yeah?
Would that be like a blue screen, something
like that? So questions, would that be like a blue screen? So a blue screen is typically what happens when the code that's running in kernel mode crashes for some reason, not necessarily because of an exception. So for example, when the code which handles a system call has an assertion in it, typically the way that assertion is going to work is it's going to trigger something like a blue screen or the OS's equivalent when it fails because there's a bug. So it's not necessarily triggered by an exception. Another case which commonly will trigger a blue screen, which is an exception, is for example, let's say we have a fault for accessing memory that's out of range in a system call handler that's running in kernel mode, that will typically trigger a blue screen. Because the OS doesn't know how to recover from that, so that's gonna give you just that message. A blue screen or the equivalent, there's kernel panic screens for every OS, which look all slightly different. But the aborts, so the things which trigger aborts are typically particular hardware problems that, are not the major cause of kernels giving up and giving you a blue screen. That's usually a software problem or a software problem that's triggered by hardware behaving weirdly, and not directly by the hardware detecting something's wrong. Yeah?
If you throw something like an out-of-bounds error, is that also called a trap?
So the question is, if I throw like a language-level exception, is that one of these? No. So these exceptions are completely independent from the types of exceptions that you deal with throw and catch. Those are completely different things that just happen to share some of the same terms. Yes.
And is the exception handler for aborts, do they differ by which machine you use?
So the question is, do the exception handlers for aborts differ by the machine you use? So typically the processor specification specifies there's a exception number for what's commonly called a machine check error. So it's basically the same based on the type of processor you have. The details of what the information might vary, but like usually that's set up in for like all of x86 has the same interface for that the hardware is going to give you the information about something went wrong. Okay. So that's about exceptions. So any other questions about exceptions before I move on? Or kernel mode? So next we're going to look at address translation in more detail. So we talked about how we run the OS, how we request services from the OS, and how we switch between programs. And we had this notion that we had this mapping where we had these addresses that the program uses, which correspond in some indirect way to the real addresses. where the idea is we can have multiple programs loaded in the memory at the same time, but each program only accesses its own stuff and can use whatever addresses it likes. So every program can have the stack at the same address, and it's not a problem because they all have a different mapping set by the OS. So we're going to have some terminology here that's going to be very important. So one is that we're going to call the addresses of program accesses virtual addresses. And this includes every address that the program can use. There is no way in your program to use anything but a virtual address. All your addresses are virtual. This includes instructions and data. Your functions are at virtual addresses. Your variables are at virtual addresses. Your pointers contain virtual addresses. It's all virtual. We have physical addresses, which are what we're going to use the name for the real addresses after we do this mapping. So we're going to have these different addresses set by this mapping. And it's not necessarily going to be the case that the two addresses even have the same size. So it could be the case that our virtual addresses are 32 bits, and our real physical addresses are like 40 bits. Or it could be the other way around. We have to go through this mapping to translate between them. So we're going to have this mapping, and there's lots of options for how we could represent this mapping. And we're going to talk about virtual memory, which is by far the most popular choice since like the 70s. And by far the most popular choice today, excluding some embedded systems. But even then, it's pretty rare to see some other sort of mapping if they're doing address translation. So we have this mapping, and I'm going to talk about what the mapping looks like, and I'm going to start with a very small memory. We're going to work up to having a full-size memory. So here, I have my toy program's memory, where my toy program has 10-bit addresses. So its virtual addresses are 10 bits, and I'm going to divide its memory into four pieces, and I'm going to call each of these pieces a page. And to make things convenient, I'm going to put different stuff in each page. So one page is going to have its code, one page is going to have its heap and its variables, one page is going to have more space for heap if we need room, otherwise we're going to leave it empty, and one space is going to have its stack. So I'm going to call each of these a page, and I'm going to number them based on their address. So I'm going to number the first one 0, the second one 1, the third one 2, and so on. So in this case, these pages are 2 to the 8 bytes, and the general pattern we'll see is that we're going to divide a program's memory into these fixed size pages. So we'll choose some power of 2 size. We'll choose a power of 2 because that makes all the math much easier in hardware because we just have to deal with bits. In this case, I chose 2 to the 8 bytes, and real hardware will choose a different size. And these are the virtual addresses the program sees, which we divided up this way. So we have these page numbers, and because I chose a power of 2 size, I can look at any address and determine what page it's in by looking at its top bits. And that's the big reason for choosing power of 2 sizes. We're going to need to do this all the time, and we sure don't want to do division all the time. But extracting a couple bits, real easy, especially in hardware. So the page number is the name we'll give to these upper bits. And we'll have to have a name for the rest of the address. We're going to call that the page offset. The idea is if you know you have an address in virtual page 1, the next other piece of information you need to know is what's its offset, and then you know exactly where I'm pointing to in memory, in virtual memory. So questions about this mapping so far? So this is how we divided up virtual addresses. These are the addresses the program sees, and we need to map those to real addresses. To physical addresses. And we're going to divide up physical memory in the same way. So I'm going to divide up physical memory into these fixed size pages, I'm going to use the same size that I use for virtual memory for each of the pages. And we're going to number these, and we're going to call these physical pages. And I'm going to number them in the same way, so I can call the upper bits of the physical address the page number. And the lower bits I'm still going to call the page offset. And I'm going to take each of these virtual pages here, and I'm going to choose one of these physical pages for each of them to reside in, or possibly none. So here, I have my mapping. I've just chosen that virtual page 0 goes to physical page 2, virtual page 3 goes to physical page 0, and so on. And I can represent this mapping not just pictorially, but as a table. So here I have a table. I have an entry for every virtual page number, which I've represented in binary, just to make it easier to see. And I have the physical page number that I'm using for each of that. And I also have the possibility that some of the virtual pages I'm deciding not to map to any physical page, so I just have none there. So this is called a page table. So questions so far? Yeah?
I'm not really sure how you just mapped this arrow.
So I just chose that I needed to put this program's data somewhere. I just chose arbitrarily places in the real memory. So it needs to go somewhere. I just chose arbitrarily. In the OS, there's going to be some algorithm for choosing which might be more intelligent than that. Other questions? Okay. So we have this page table, and the idea is that the processor is going to look at this page table, and every time we access some address, it's going to look at this page table and translate that address to the physical address that the cache expects and that the real memory expects that we need to pass to that. So what this looks like is we have our page table. We have our physical page numbers in it. We have a valid bit because remember we had this none entry and I need to represent this in bits physically. So like for caches, if we want to ignore an entry, we're not going to just set it to 0 because that's some value which could be there. We're going to have this extra bit indicating, does this entry contain anything? And if not, we're going to ignore it. And we're going to take our address, and we're going to look up a row in this table, and we're going to get out the physical page number. And what we're going to do is we're going to substitute the virtual page number in the address for the physical page number. The rest of the address remains the same, because if we want the beginning of a virtual page in the program, that should translate to the beginning of a physical page. If we want near the end of a physical page, a virtual page, that should translate to the end of a physical page. So the page offset remains unchanged. We just pass through those bits. And since we can have holes in our page table, we also have this extra valid bit, and we check. And if it's 0, we trigger that exception that ends up being a segmentation fault that you know about. Okay. And each of these rows in the page table that we look up is called a page table entry. And we look up a page table entry based on the virtual page number. That's the name for the page number in the virtual address. And what we look up, besides the valid bit, is called a physical page number. And the rest of the address in either the virtual or physical address is called the page offset. And as you might guess, these are terms that we expect you to know. So questions? Yeah.
Number of bits used for virtual address and physical address. After the translation, we're going to have a different number of bits. And we're going to change the number of bits for the whole address, right?
So the question is, if we have different number of virtual and physical address bits, we change the number of bits in the translation? Yes. So this example shows that. And the way we had different numbers of bits is we decided to have only 2 bits for the page numbers at the beginning, and we ended up with 3 bits for our physical page numbers. And that's where we got the extra bit from this table. And that is, it is pretty common in real processors that the number of bits in virtual addresses and physical addresses will disagree. Usually actually in the other direction, but they will often disagree. Yeah?
Let's say you had an array of, a large array of integers, could that overlap multiple pages?
So the question is, can datum overlap multiple pages? Absolutely. If the address happens to change this bit, then you're going to another page and you're not going to notice because it's going to do the translation for every access you do.
Would that be a problem with cache locality if the pages are in different places on physical memory?
So the question is, could this be a problem with cache locality? Absolutely. Yeah, it could be. It's typically not such a big deal as you might imagine, partly because the L1 caches typically are set up with this in mind. And so they typically don't have enough, they typically set up their tag index and offset such that the index bits do not include any part of the page number for the L1. And partly because they know that that bad locality would happen. So other questions? Okay, so as I mentioned earlier, we switch address spaces, which are privileged instruction. So we've learned now that switching address spaces means changing this page table. So there's some privileged instructions for changing the page table, and that's how we do that. We need the code that does the switching to be in memory. So the way we're going to do that is by adding a way of having a page table point to it, but we need to make it so that the OS's code that switches the page tables can't be edited by the program in order to, you know, do something, change the page table to something the program's not supposed to be able to access. Because that would let the program escape user mode. We just put the code we want to run in the code which switches the page table, and now it runs in kernel mode. That's bad. So we'll have some extra bits in our page table, and we'll see more extra bits later. So here I have this extra kernel-only bit in each row. So we do the same lookup, and now we have this extra bit which tells us, can I only access this in kernel mode? And I look at that bit, and if it's 1 and I'm in user mode, I trigger an exception, just like I might trigger an exception sometimes if it was invalid. Okay, so questions? Yes. Okay, so preview us for next time. So we talked about virtual addresses. So I'm going to tell you something nasty about real machines that you think, oh, x86, my virtual address is 64 bits. Well, not really. So x86 doesn't use the entire 64-bit address for this page table lookup. So it, on 64-bit x86, it only uses 48 bits of the address, and the rest of the bits have a fixed value. That fixed value is their copies of the signed bit. And when we talk about virtual address sizes, we're going to talk about how much space is used for mapping. Now, even with only 48 bits, you might notice a problem. That if you think about our page table here, it's going to turn out that even with pretty large page sizes, it's really big. That seems bad, so we're going to have better ways of encoding the page table that deal with this. So one problem you might say is, where can we put this page table? So we're going to have a solution for that, and you might say, you know, might say, it's still too big, even if we have a place to put it, so we'll also have a solution to make it smaller. And that's what we'll cover next week. And that's what I'll leave up there for today.